This is Line One, your health connection, a weekly program produced at the studios of KSKA. Each week, KSKA's host, Dr. Thad Woodard, puts you in touch with local and national experts in a variety of health and family issues. Opinions expressed are those of the host, guest, and callers, and do not represent those of KSKA, the licensee, or the underwriters. Here's your host, Dr. Thad Woodard.
Good afternoon. Welcome once again to Line One, your health connection. Our topic today is hospice, and we want to make sure our listeners are aware of what hospice is all about and what it's not about. And so if it seems appropriate, you can take advantage of that. And I'll introduce my guests shortly. Before I do that, I feel like it is reasonable to bring up some information about swine flu. This has the potential for becoming a very big issue, and it has a tremendous potential for getting blown out of proportion as well. So I felt some basics would be worthwhile. We in the United States, first off, use some semantic words or semantics incorrectly, in that we often use the word flu to mean any virus, sometimes causing vomiting and diarrhea and gastroenteritis, sometimes colds. And that confuses the issue with one particular type of virus that is known as influenza. Influenza, in this sense, is a flu, but it's distinct in that it's much more than the common cold virus. And although vomiting and diarrhea may be a part, it's not the major part. The major part of influenza is achiness, fever as a general rule, cough and respiratory congestion. Some vomiting and diarrhea may be a component in some individuals. It is longer lasting than typical respiratory viruses and colds, may last 7 to 10 days with considerable amount of risk to individuals who are elderly, who are otherwise have their immune system affected, for example, by cancer or other chronic diseases, and causes in the neighborhood in this country of about 40 to 45,000 excess deaths each year, primarily in the winter. The virus adapts and changes frequently by making changes in its DNA. And so each year, the national CDC and other experts try to guess ahead of time which vaccine will be most effective and provides that vaccine. Occasionally, the influenza vaccine or the influenza disease will jump from another mammalian or avian species. It's both in birds and other mammals, and usually that doesn't happen, but occasionally it will happen. It is felt that the pandemic, which means a worldwide outbreak of influenza, which happened in 1919 and led to millions of deaths, was a situation where the swine flu virus jumped into the human population. We've known that there have been rare scattered cases of humans being infected from with swine flu from other swine in the United States and around the world, but at a very low rate. There's not been a lot of person-to-person transmission. Currently, that is not the case. There is a lot of person-to-person transmission occurring. There are now 40 documented cases in the United States. There's cases being documented not only in Mexico, but in Spain and New Zealand. So this will, with the current transportation ease throughout the world, spread rapidly without little question. The big concern will be how deadly will this situation be, and will it just be like a common influenza outbreak, which does have some significant morbidity and mortality, but could be easily handled. At this time, those individuals who've been infected and reported in the United States have not died, with the exception of one person who was hospitalized who was already immune deficient. So it seems at this point that it's going to be pretty mild, but we don't know. So what can you do? You need to educate yourself, and I would strongly recommend you check with the CDC website, and we have put that link up on our website. If you don't remember that, just go to cdc.gov/swineflu. It'll have daily updates. There's also links to other bits of information. You can prevent spread by the typical way. You don't cough and don't sneeze on each other. If you're sick or you think you're becoming ill, try not to share bottles of water, or especially for athletes. I think about that, having a couple of kids that are into soccer right now. Wash hands. And if you're sick, try to stay at home. If you think you're becoming ill, we can potentially diagnose this illness. And there are, fortunately, two antiviral agents that appear to be successful against this strain. However, the current immunizations that have been used this year in the recent past are not very effective against prevention of the spread of this virus. So educate yourself. Be aware that there will be a tremendous amount of misinformation on the internet, which is a frequent source of information for people, and stick with reliable sources, and particularly the cdc.gov/swineflu would be my suggestion. Today, as I said, we're talking about hospice, and I've got three individuals in the studio today, all of which who work for Amedisys. Dr. Sergei Bogoyavlinsky,
right,
is the medical director, and he's with me. Their chaplain, Diane Johnson, and a nurse, and I think you have other responsibilities, Crystal, you told me about before. I wasn't aware of them, but we can get into that. So let's start with some of the basics, as I usually do. If someone would just maybe give me an idea of what they conceptualize as the idea behind hospice, and then maybe a little bit of history, both nationally and internationally, on this movement.
Well, you know, hospice can be traced back as far as medieval times, and it referred to a shelter where the weary travelers and those that were ill could rest. And so we take that same concept into today, where people are at the end of their life and want to be at home, so we help them stay at home. Dr. Cicely Saunders, first brought the idea of hospice here to the States in 67. And the first hospice here in the United States was the Connecticut Hospice in 1974. So the idea has been around for a long time. And Anchorage has had hospice as a group here since, for the last 25 years. So it's been around. It's just...
Wow. So there's 25 hospices, or there have been hospices
for 25 years. Yeah.
Okay. I was surprised by that a little bit. That's, I guess, good to hear. Well, before we came on the air, we talked about the fact that maybe it's not utilized as much in Alaska as it has been in other states. And so I was taken back a little bit by the history of it being here 25 years. So let's perhaps talk about that aspect a little bit.
Well, Hospice of Anchorage has been here for 25 years. They were the only hospice provider here until... I believe Denali Hospice started in 2003, and then Providence started a hospice, I believe, 2 years ago. And so previously it was a very, very small organization, Hospice of Anchorage. They're a wonderful bunch, a nonprofit funded by community donations in the United Way. So they've been here, but they've been very small, and because of the combination of them being very small and providers not quite knowing how to use hospice, it's been very in the kind of background.
And Hospice of Anchorage has done an amazing effort to educate our community. I mean, that's really at the heart of their organization is getting out there and teaching people about hospice and what that means. End-of-life care, grief and bereavement, they offer just a very good outreach education.
Dr. Bogoyavlinsky, you mentioned to me before we came on the program that you'd started by working out into the bush a little bit outside of Anchorage, and we've heard that the hospice idea is something that has been around for a long, long time. How is the end of life care different, perhaps out in Kotzebue or on some of the native areas, as compared to what you see happen in Anchorage or Fairbanks?
Well, there's a reluctance in the native community to leave the village at the end of life, and unfortunately, we have a centralized medical system in the state. All the non-primary care specialties are centered in Fairbanks and Anchorage and Juneau to some extent. So that for actual formal hospice care, that there is no such organization. There have been, has been talk about branching out into rural Alaska. But what we see is people who come to Anchorage realize that they're terminally ill and go back to the villages where being with family and in familiar surroundings is the most important consideration.
It seems to me that is hospice. That's similar to hospice. If I'm wrong, correct me.
No, I think I completely agree with you. When Diane was talking about the history of hospice, it seems to be a new medical specialty. But in fact, my feeling on it is that hospice type care and compassionate care of the dying has been with medicine as long as we know, going back to Hippocrates and beyond. So that in many ways, I feel that hospice is kind of in the age-old tradition of doctoring and nursing, whereas the high-tech jousting with death and disease is kind of a new emphasis and a new enthusiasm. Which, if you think about it, is in many ways wonderful, but in other ways, it's doomed to defeat.
You mentioned before, Crystal, that perhaps one of the reasons that hospice in Alaska or in Anchorage, and specifically, maybe slow on the uptake, it may have something to do with cultural differences and awareness of this. I'd like to expand on what Sergi had to say about some of the cultural things, and you'd mentioned similar things. We may have too much of a need to prolong life for various reasons, I think, if I can.
Yeah, and when I say that about culturally, I don't mean specifically Alaskan culture, but just Western,
right? Okay.
Western culture. We here in the West tend to be so technological that we think we can beat it, and that we have to treat death as a medical problem, mm-hmm. and it's really a natural process. But I think it's really difficult for people in the West to recognize it as natural, as to where a lot of other cultures in the East, India, and, you know, recognize it as the next natural progression. And I think we don't talk about it as much. People don't even like to say the word. And we tiptoe around and use terms like life-limiting illness, terminal disease, things like that, because we don't even want to say death. Mm-hmm. And so I think that's a big barrier. And I think one of the things I actually wanted to say when we talk about hospice being age old, it truly is. I think what's newer and is making people look at it differently and think of it as newer is the Medicare benefit for hospice. That's newer. When the first actual hospice started in Connecticut, people started looking at reimbursement for it and insurances and Medicare. And so that is the newer piece of it. I think the idea has been around forever.
So there are special challenges to patients and families who are faced with death. Certain doctors and nurses and chaplains are more comfortable dealing with it. It is a kind of specialty. There are things that come up over and over again that aren't quite as well known to other medical practitioners.
Such as?
Well, for example, all of the pain control, of course, is a very big part of hospice, and familiarity with the medicines and how to use them safely and their side effects. It isn't terribly complicated, but on the other hand, if you don't have patients with problems like that every week, you may be a little vague about it.
So like anything, I'm fond to say we're good at what we do all the time. And so those of us, or those of you, I don't, deal with hospice all the time. There are issues of pain and end-of-life care that you get good at because you're so familiar with dealing with it. And you end up, I think, probably good at it because you recognize that there's lots of different ways that families approach this problem. And so you kind of have that experience of how to handle different ways that it happened. It's not something that you're usually just taught and remember. You have to have that experience for that.
Correct. And part of that is why we approach it from an interdisciplinary mm-hmm. team approach, because it's not just about the medical management of the pain. It's about the grief, the pain and loss that the family is feeling. It's about spiritual pain. It's about cultural diversity, all of those things. And so that's why it has been put together as a team approach. It's not just about medical management. We have a medical director who oversees all of our plans of care. We have certified hospice nurses. We have the spiritual counselor, bereavement counselor, social worker. Home health aide to help with activities of daily living, all of those kind of things, to try and provide people with the very best quality that they can have for as long as they can have it, and assist the family in being able to honor someone's wishes to be at home and be comfortable and have dignity and peace in their passing.
And Diane, you're a chaplain, and I'd like to mm-hmm. bring in the issue of, is that a typical place for a chaplain to be in hospice care, or is it a medicine unique in that situation?
Oh,
and
no,
then,
no.
And then specifically, what drew you to this?
Yeah. Well, you know, as far as a holistic approach to mm-hmm. hospice, you know, you can't leave out that spiritual mm-hmm. component. And what Sergei was talking about, you know, physical pain and to recognize spiritual pain, because you could throw pain medications all day at physical pain and that spiritual pain remains. So I was really drawn to hospice through work that I did with AIDS patients many years ago, 20 years ago, and saw a lot of hospice happening, and so just naturally came into the hospice realm that way.
It's kind of artificial sometimes to think in terms of the disease itself and then everything else. But everything else is often the most important. And it is, and here's a person with an illness. And each person is affected differently in terms of their view of things, the ideas they have about what even caused it, what's going to happen, what they're afraid of the most. And people have very different views of the world. It doesn't get you very far in trying to help and understand if you just focus on the biology and the technology.
All right. I'd like to come back and keep going on that line. That's really interesting to me, but I need to take a short break. You're listening to Line 1, Your Health Connection on KSKA. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard.
Providence, Alaska combines state-of-the-art technology with a team of skilled and experienced physicians and nurses. With locations in Anchorage, Wasilla, Seward, Valdez, and Kodiak, Providence offers needed medical care close to home. For more information, log on to providence.org/Alaska. This message is sponsored by Providence Alaska Medical Center.
This is Line One. I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard, and today we're talking about hospice with three individuals who are representing Amadeus, Amedesis. I'm getting mixed up with Mozart here for a second. Amedesis Hospice. So if you've got questions or comments or experiences you'd like to share, let me give you a couple of ways that you can get in touch with us between now and just before 3 o'clock today, Anchorage time. Our local number is 550-8433. 550-8433. Outside of Anchorage, our toll-free number 1-888-353-5752, and you can email us at line1, and it's L-I-N-E-O-N-E at kska.org. We'll entertain and answer questions and put you on the air between now and 3 o'clock. We also repeat tonight at 8 o'clock online on KSKA 91.1, but there will be no questions taken at that time. Dr. Bogojavlinsky, how about expanding on your thoughts? You were saying that the biology of illness is one thing, but then there's this cultural aspect that everybody sees things differently, and we even see the world differently. So we certainly, those of us who take care of people, realize that others have very, very different ideas about illness and health and dying.
They certainly do. It varies from person to person, family to family, and of course, culture, background, education, and previous life experience. And I feel that it is impossible to address a given patient's concerns without understanding some of that, at least. There's no easy road. These cultural competency courses that have sprung up or a start, but there just isn't any quick solution to it. I think that leaving yourself open to surprises, which so many of our colleagues, Dr. Woodard and I, are very unhappy with in their daily practice, is a prerequisite, especially here. One of the observations that many doctors have that have come to Alaska and have practiced in Anchorage in particular, but also in the valley, is that our Alaskan population is relatively transient. Americans move a lot everywhere, but once they've made the move here, they don't have the family and the friendship networks that so many people in more established and older communities have in the lower 48. With lower birth rates, people have fewer cousins than did the generation of our grandparents. And then add on top of that, moving to Alaska. I mean, so many times you come and see a patient postoperatively in the hospital and you kind of inevitably ask, well, has anybody visited you? And in Alaska, the answer is no, more frequently in my experience.
Yeah, I think we find when we're trying to care for a hospice patient at home, when they come to a point where they need a 24-hour caregiver, I see a little more trouble here having enough family to help take care of them than I've seen elsewhere. Mm-hmm. But that's just kind of jumping back to where Dr. Bogojavlinsky was talking about addressing those separate issues rather than just the medical part. We tend, at least my opinion in healthcare, we tend to try to be everything to our patients. You're a nurse, you also then try to deal with all of their psychosocial issues and their spiritual issues. And, you know, we need to recognize that there are people, other people, that are trained and better at that and approach people in a much more kind of a team approach, which is why hospice has chaplains. And it's a condition of Medicare participation to have that team, because we need to recognize that one care provider can't be all to every patient and every family.
Okay. We've got a couple of callers. I'd like to take their experiences, it looks like they want to discuss, so let's do that. Heather, you're on line one.
Thank you very much. Yes, I have two very specific experiences. When my mother passed away in 2000, and her care was just exceptional. And when my own husband was killed in an accident, I went to hospice counseling after I returned home. He was killed in Europe. And to have that counseling, it wasn't just the counseling, it was the sharing of information among the various participants that was very valuable, because going through the maze of agencies and issues after a death in the family, it can be very daunting. But I'd like to add a couple of comments to this. I've been familiar with hospice since it started here in Anchorage, and frankly even before that, and the system has changed. I remember when there was no such thing as insurance reimbursements or Medicare, any of that. And now that it has become acceptable and is frankly a much less expensive method of dealing with ultimately dying, I've seen other players get into the marketplace. In some cases, it becomes a cost center for Providence. But there are also for-profit businesses out there providing care, and I would like your panel of experts to speak to that area. But I want to make one more comment, and that is that there was a program on Fresh Air, Terry Gross, about 2 or 3 weeks ago, and I really need to look it up online, but it was an ER doctor who was talking about end of life and the horrible things that happen to people when the medical system tries to keep them alive longer than their bodies are able to keep alive. And they're very clear that the doctor said that it was organ support, not life support. And it went into some detail on end-of-life treatment, and I appreciate your panelist who said today that it's not culturally very proper for us to talk about death, and I think it's high time we get over that and talk about it, because it makes it a whole lot easier on families, both the older and the younger people, the dying and the still alive. And I'd appreciate any comments you have on for-profit versus not-for-profit and any other end-of-life things. Thank you.
All right. Thanks for your call. Couple of issues. How about the profit versus non-profit as far as hospice care? You have any comments?
Yeah, I have actually worked for non-profit and for-profit hospices. Amedisys is a for-profit. I've worked for three nonprofits and three for-profit hospices, and the care, the philosophy are all the same. Hospice is a philosophy of care. It's the difference is who's providing it. And in my experience, what's given to the families, what's given to the patients is not different. I'm not sure if that was exactly the question, but...
Any other comments?
I think your, Heather, your image of life support versus organ support is a very apt one. And I think that that's kind of the emphasis of hospice and should be. Doctors are always blamed for being more interested in organs than they are in an individual person. The other comment I would like to say, just sort of in balance, to balance the somewhat philosophical points that we've been making, and that is that hospice is, to my thinking, very, very practical. Americans and American families are not especially prepared for death. And they really don't know the ins and outs of how to set things up. And the hospice team, of course, deals with this day in and day out, and brings a very practical, non-judgmental kind of a point of view to things. There are little tricks and big tricks that come up all the time to make people comfortable.
We have another caller, and I want to hold off. I guess I always have to put my 10 cents worth in, as I think there's a tendency to think that there might be huge differences between profit and nonprofit, and particularly in healthcare. And I would be, I think, remiss not to point out that has to do with how organizations are taxed. It doesn't have much to do necessarily with the provision of care. You could be a nonprofit straining to have the financial wherewithal to do what you needed to do, so that there might be problems by being a nonprofit. And you could be a for-profit and be highly ethical and providing some of the leading aspects of care in an area. So I would encourage all of us to keep an open mind about what's happening, not necessarily what a tax designation is in an organization, although it's an easy way to think about things. But both organizations have to make money or they wouldn't be in business, I would point out.
Correct.
Gene, you're on line one.
Oh, thank you. Thank you for taking my call. I'd like to compliment hospice. I used them in 1987. My wife died that year. And she was a very young woman, and I was totally at risk. I didn't know how to handle any of this. She had melanoma cancer, and when we found out she had it, and we had gone through all the normal routine treatments and the research projects and so forth in the lower 48, when she was determined to be terminal, hospice stepped in, and I compliment the service for the pain control and the fact that she was allowed to die in dignity rather than, you know, being put into a hospital and being on life support. We had a non-resuscitate order. She was forced in a hospital one time, and I was out of town. And at that time, her friends took care of her. And the hospice worker met at the hospital, showed a non-resuscitate order, and he immediately said, okay, we understand. And he treated her, stabilized her, sent her back home. And just the fact, the support, the family support or the spiritual support was fantastic. I mean, it's very true. There's, in the United States, death is something we don't talk about, and I was able to sit down and kind of go through and not really face the anger of that someone that I love was dying, but the fact that it's just part of a life cycle that occurs. The pain control part was just, to this day, it still amazes me how fast hospice could get things done and how they'd step in immediately, be able to diagnose what was happening, have a medication that would handle a situation within a matter of, it seemed like just hours, things would be back under control. And it was just it was an experience, you know. You don't want to think about the fact of dying as an experience that is, you know, but it happens, and it just made an experience that was, to her, she had so much dignity when she died, and that's what I want to compliment her on.
Okay. All right, thanks for your call and sharing with us on that, Gene. Appreciate it.
Okay.
You know, one of the things we maybe have not done that needs to be done is to really ferret out specifically what all hospice offers. What are all the different services? It sounds like, listening to Gene, who just called, that this is an all-encompassing, helping a family cope and come to grips with all the issues at the end of death, end of life. And those are considerable. Is that fair to say? I mean, it seems like hospice grabs hold of all of those issues, but we haven't spelled them out.
True, that's absolutely true. And it's not just about the patient or just about the family, but the entire group of people that are involved. But there's also the technical pieces of that. We work with symptom management, pain control, all other symptoms. We talked about the social worker can help people navigate the healthcare system, help them look for resources for different things. We have our chaplain and bereavement counselor for that piece. But also we provide durable medical equipment, hospital beds, oxygen, all of those kind of things are covered under people's Medicare hospice benefit. And we coordinate all of that. The nurse that's in charge of a particular case is responsible for all of those things, and we try to have them all in place. From pharmacy, we cover all of the medications related to the terminal illness and the symptom management. We obtain all of the physician's orders, have the medications ordered, delivered to the home, We try to really minimize the amount of those things that the family has to do so they can be the family. There also are the caregiver that's there 24 hours a day. Hospice does not provide 24-hour in-home care except in the event of some sort of crisis. We spend a lot of time educating the family and teaching the caregivers how to manage these things. One of the most important things that we do is to make sure that people have the tools in the home for anything unexpected that comes up. Sometimes something really unexpected comes up, but we contract with pharmacy, medical equipment companies, physician, so that we have access to those things 24 hours a day for people.
I'm going to remind our listeners once again, you're listening to Line 1. Our topic today is hospice. If you've got questions or comments, just a couple of ways to get in touch with us so you can make your comments or ask your questions. Our local number, 550-8433, 550-8433, an outside toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752, and you can email us now before 3 o'clock at Line 1, LINEONE at KSKA.org. Diane, how about this issue of people who may come to hospice and not being aware of the prognosis, what's going to happen, when it's going to happen, and then how each individual may come to grips with the idea that the end of life is coming? How do you help them with that? What are the different experiences you've had that you might want to share?
Well, you know, it really starts, we'd hope it would start with the primary care physician starting to have those conversations. But often it's a diagnosis is given and a referral to hospice, mm-hmm. and then it goes right into our hands. Mm-hmm. And from the moment we get a referral and go and visit the family and the patient and talk about what hospice is, that's where the education piece starts, right there. A lot of questions are asked, you know, how much longer do I have to live? Well, we don't know that. But here's what we can do today, tomorrow, you know, with symptoms, quality of life. What is it that you want to do tomorrow? What do you want to do today? And we'll help make that happen. So, you know, our whole team, we meet, we talk about our patients, we look at our patients' goals and come together and try and make that happen. One piece that I wanted to bring up, and I apologize to all hospice volunteers out there for not including, putting in a big kudos, because there are many hospice volunteers in our community that have been specifically trained to work with hospice patients directly and their families. And if someone is looking for an opportunity to volunteer with hospice, any of the hospices here in Anchorage would be glad to have someone as a volunteer. And that the volunteer is part of the whole hospice team as well, providing respite, giving a chance for family members to go shop or just to get out and try and do something that they normally would do, and just take that break from what's happening in the home. So
it seems to me one of the really important bits of counseling, although those of listening may not think of it as counseling, I do, and maybe that's inappropriate, but you're going to that person and that family and saying, well, what's your expectations? You know, what do you want to accomplish? How do you want to accomplish that? Where are you in your thinking? And helping them really get a grip on that, and at the same time recognize that, yeah, there's a lot of things we don't understand and we can't predict, but let's make the quality of what's mm-hmm. left as good as we can. If I think about hospice as a generic idea, that's kind of it, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. And as a chaplain, you know, I come into the realm of the patient's world from a spiritual point of view and really trying to help them tap into that and see what that means for them. Mm-hmm. It's not a religious agenda. It's not about religion. It may be for the patient, mm-hmm. but from a hospice point of view, we're really looking at what, you know, what holds meaning in that patient's life, mm-hmm. and how can we address that? How is that being addressed through the work that we do?
So if you were agnostic or atheist, that doesn't mean you shouldn't participate in a hospice experience.
Well, we've had plenty of those.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, so this is not about religion.
No, not at all. Not at all.
It's about the broad sense of belief system and trying to help individuals with that broad spectrum of belief systems.
Right, we don't bring an agenda in that sense. Mm-hmm. We are there to support the patient in whatever their beliefs and whatever brings meaning into their life.
Okay. Even people who say they don't believe, that's a belief system and needs to be addressed, needs to be recognized and honored.
Okay, we have another caller. I want to take that, and then I'd really like to get back to surgery and talk about the pain issues. There's a number of issues around that I think there may be misconceptions about. Jean, you're on line one.
Okay, I'll just quickly add to what you're saying. Many years ago, when hospice here was young and was all volunteers, I had nursed my husband with a Gaucheng, which you can explain if you want to, for 6 months. I was pretty good at it, but the hospice volunteer was so welcome because I could talk to her about the little frustrations. I broke the tube last night. I had to wake up 3 times because it blocked. Stuff that I wouldn't bore my friends and neighbors with, I could talk to her about. It was so nice. It was hospice for the caregiver. And I just wanted to add that to what you just said, and then let you get on to the more important part.
All right, Jean. Thanks again very much.
You're welcome.
Have a good day.
You know, that's really true, that hospice just isn't for the patient.
Mm-hmm.
It's for the whole family, and even continues beyond the death of the patient, continuing with bereavement, grief work, following that patient for a year up to, after the patient has died, continuing the check-in and maintaining that relationship.
I think we're becoming a little bit more educated about pain and pain control and addiction issues and what works and what doesn't, but there's a whole slew of issues around that. And, Sergio, you're the physician, so I'm going to ask you about misconceptions about pain, success of pain control at the end of life now.
Well, I'll start off with a positive note, and that is that I think that for the most part, any kind of pain can be controlled, and for the most part, without sacrificing the quality of life of that person. In other words, zonking them to where they're oblivious. I think there have been some advances, partly technical, biological, and understanding, but also kind of lifting the mystery from pain control. The hardest thing about pain control sometimes is that you can tell me how much pain you're having, but I can't tell him how much pain you're having. There are rules of thumb for looking at people, whether they grimace or look away, and so on. I think that there's been a real improvement in making that those kinds of insights available. I mean, the now decades-long pain scale on a scale of 0 to 10, where is your pain? That's a start. It doesn't always work, as we know. Another big issue has been the kind of taboo and fear of narcotics, of opiates. Many physicians are reluctant to prescribe them in general because of a kind of a feeling that Big Brother is watching you, or the patients are going to somehow become dependent and it's my fault. So that's been an issue. I happen to have talked to one of our local DEA agents who says that the DA is very concerned that terminally ill patients do get the right pain medicines. Doesn't seem to be a problem with them. The other issue, of course, is that there's a certain generation of Americans who think that going on narcotics shows weakness, and also irrationally they are afraid of quote becoming addicted, unquote. It's amazing how many times Crystal and Diane and I hear that a patient's family doesn't want her to have narcotics because they might just become a junkie. Well, those are some of the issues. But I think all of that is probably getting better. There's some more light on it. Since the discovery of the opioid receptors, only in the 1970s, do we understand more about it. And you can tell patients that our own bodies make narcotic-like substances in order to deal with pain.
So how do you address the issue when someone says, I'm worried that my loved one's going to become dependent on an opiate for their pain relief?
Well, first of all, everybody's different, and you try to look and see what they're concerned with. But what we say is that sometimes opiates are the only thing that will work, and that it is really, as I just mentioned a minute ago, it is actually a fairly, quote, natural way of doing things. And addiction is a very negative term, which has all kinds of criminal connotations. And what I try to do is to show that that's completely irrelevant in this setting.
Mm-hmm. We also talk to them a lot about when they think of being addicted, it's sometimes really what they're talking about is the abuse of the drugs. Mm-hmm. And that when things are regulated and they're taught, usually just a lot of talking and getting down to what it is they're really afraid of. Sometimes once you get down to it, you'll finally hear, well, I'm just really afraid that once I start taking the narcotic, then I'm going to die. There's usually some other fear base in there, and it just takes time to get down to what it is. And talking to them rationally about the fact that you're not going to become addicted to something because you're not abusing it.
Right, and we're coming back to what is the goal? You know, what is the goal for your family, mm-hmm. for yourself, to be pain-free, to be symptom-free? And here's a solution, and here's how we can start that at a very, very small dose and work and see where it's going to end and where we can stop, where we can start. So,
did you ever run into the concern that you're going to hasten death by your efforts to control pain?
All the time. And we talk a lot. We talk a lot to people about what's happening with them physically, and try to help them understand that we don't hasten death or prolong life. We try to provide quality. And so there's a place that they get to when their symptoms progress. They may start to have more pain because of whatever pathological process is happening in their body. And that usually coincides with needing to increase narcotics and just helping them recognize that it's the process that's bringing on the need for the narcotic rather than the other way around. So we just do an awful lot of teaching, and we do sometimes run into people who choose to bear more pain than take more narcotics. Mm-hmm. And that's their choice. If they have all of the information that they need, we honor that piece of their choice as well.
Again, you're listening to The Line One. We're talking about hospice care. If you have comments or questions, 550-8433 is our local number. We have about 10 minutes left in the program, 550-8433. Or you can email at lineone, lineone, at kska.org. And remember, if you have someone you'd like to listen to the program later, refer them to kska.org/lineone, where they can listen to this broadcast at any time. You can also subscribe to the podcast through the usual mechanisms. When and how should the decision be made about entering hospice? I get the feeling from talking with you it's often too late. So how do we encourage people to think about it earlier, and is that appropriate?
I think that it's very appropriate and it's very important. I think the earlier you can get connected with a hospice agency, the more time you have to learn and be prepared. And I think the time that those discussions should start is as soon as there's a diagnosis. Even if you plan to go through an attempt at curative treatment, I think that the discussion of this may become an option in the future should be started so that hospice is not a word that just comes up at the very, very end and then sometimes takes on a negative connotation. I think it should begin, and as soon as that diagnosis is made, those talks should happen. Now, you can't actually enroll in a Medicare certified hospice until the physician says, "I believe that if this disease follows its natural course of progression, it will be 6 months or less." But that doesn't mean that those connections can't be made, that we can't meet with families and talk with them and have them ready for when that time happens.
Or that family couldn't talk with a physician about, is this an appropriate thing to be considering right now?
Because
sometimes the physicians may not be thinking about it or may not be aware of it and so forth, so it's not inappropriate.
Not at all.
You know, and I think in general we encourage people to have those conversations while you're healthy even. I mean, what do you want your quality of life? What would you like your end of life to look like? You know, get the five wishes document. You know, write down exactly what you would want, what your quality of life, how you would like that to be. Tell all your friends, make copies. I mean, we have a lot of patients that come to us, don't have much family, and family members have one idea of what it should look like. The patient may be at a late stage where they're nonverbal or they can't make their wishes known. So I would just encourage people to have those conversations today. I mean, have those conversations. And so if you find yourself in a situation, and hospice won't be such a scary word, it will be what it is that you've wanted all the time, you know, all along.
Yeah, part of your
quality
plan.
Of life.
And I think you'd be hard-pressed to find a hospice worker anywhere whose family doesn't know exactly what they want. And I think that just behooves everyone in the general public. You talk to your family about, would you ever want to be put on life support? Would you ever want this? All of your quality at end of life should be talked about.
Mm-hmm. I want to mention briefly, I got an email from Jeff, and he mentions that he's helped and been involved with four people during their last days, and he felt that many of the physicians still had a lot of reticence with using appropriate pain control, and it's certainly painful for me. We've done a number of programs, at least a couple of programs on hospice, a couple of programs on pain control, and I think at least the public should also be aware that the issue of addiction and physicians getting in problem with pain control when it's done appropriate is not an issue anymore. I don't want to overstate it, Sergey, but that's my understanding.
Oh, I think you're right.
But I think some physicians are still very uncomfortable. I have had patients referred to hospice, and the phone call that I got from the doctor's office was, well, you know, we're not really sure, but the doctor's just not comfortable prescribing this amount of narcotics anymore. Mm-hmm. Will you please take over? Mm-hmm. And so I think it's still a big fear.
Mm-hmm. Well, I can understand how physicians may not be familiar if they don't do it all the time, and then that's fine.
Sure.
Okay, but not stand in the way and prevent it from being done. There are people who specialize in pain, and there's people who are doing palliative and in hospice care that are very talented in that.
An observation that comes up, which is a little bit counterintuitive, but many people have observed that when a very sick patient enters hospice and they get the kind of attention and care and rethinking of, for example, of things like drug regimens, the patients actually improve. They feel better. They have a new kind of a new lease on life. And it's the physicians that are involved in taking care of these mortal illnesses have a very different perspective. And so all kinds of drugs are piled on, justifiably usually. But then the time comes to sort of back off. And as you know, one of my jobs is to sit in our interdisciplinary meetings and say, somebody's not doing well, what drugs can we take them off?
Uh-huh.
And it's amazing sometimes. The patients come in kind of like an archaeological site of all the different doctors that have camped on their case and have left their medicines with them. And as you know, one of President Obama's agendas is electronic medical records. And hopefully that'll clear some of that up, because often we don't know what the patient, why the patient's been put on this or that. There have been a couple of large studies which have shown that if you do case by case matching, that people with certain malignancies actually live longer in hospice significantly than if they do not receive hospice care.
That's true, and they live better and much more functional, and just people just feel better and are happier at home with the people they love and in their familiar surroundings.
Mm-hmm. I really only have 2 minutes left. We have three callers holding. I'm going to have to apologize to the people who called in that we're not getting to them, but I would like each of you to perhaps leave us with a thought or two. I like to do this at the end of the program because people don't remember much of what we talked about all the time. So what are the lessons? What are the things we want people to listen to in the last 2 minutes?
For me, I think people have those conversations with your family. And talk about what you want at the end of life. Know what you want at the end of life. And choose a hospice provider that's going to meet your needs. The philosophy of care is the same. The differences in personnel and sometimes just the ins and outs of what's going to fit with your life. Who can meet your needs the best.
Diane, we're down to a minute.
Yeah, I'm just thinking quality of life. Really examine what that means to you. And again, like Crystal said, have that conversation with your family so that everyone else knows what that means to you as well.
Yeah, we all kind of keep that in and don't want to talk about it. Sergi?
Just a piece of practical advice, and that is that bring it up with your doctor. Mm-hmm. I ask your doctor what she thinks of hospice. And whether it's when it's going to be appropriate for you, I think doctors need to be asked that question.
Kiddo? Well, thanks very much. I want to remind our listeners that these guests today are all from Amedisys Hospice here in Anchorage. And I've got a link to their website on our homepage, and a couple of other websites that may give you information. What's your local phone number?
Local phone number is 272-0204.
Okie doke. Thanks again for taking the time to be with us today. It was enjoyable.
Thanks for having us.
Next week, we're going to move on to something different, as is typical, and we're going to be talking about women's health. In particular, we will be talking about pregnancy and birth with Judy Narsigian. Judy is a co-author of a book series called Our Bodies, Ourselves, and the most recent one is called Pregnancy and Birth. So tune into your health and learn more Monday, May 4th at 2 p.m., repeating the same evening at 8 p.m. on FM 91.1. For Line One, this is Dr. Thad Woodard.
Your Health Connection. If you have questions or comments concerning this program, write us at 3877 University Drive, Anchorage, Alaska, 99508, or email us at line1@ksKA.org. Additional information on today's show topic, including relevant website links, will be posted along with audio of today's program on our website at ksKA.org/line1. CD copies of this program can be purchased by calling 550-8400 during regular business hours. This is KSKA, Anchorage.